Call the next case, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Jim Kwan. I represent the appellant, Julia Ping, in this matter. May it please the court. I would also like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The issue before the court is whether Section 315A of the Virginia Code requires school boards to conduct a school board hearing prior to suspending employees without pay. In this case, Fairfax County School Board either was required to conduct the school board hearing prior to suspending Ms. Payne without pay, but failed to do so, or Fairfax County School Board lacked the ability or the authority to suspend her at all. I'd like to start with just a brief history of 315A and some decisions or some analysis that was performed that we would say is persuasive authority with regard to the meaning of 315A. Specifically, in 1983, the Virginia Attorney General issued an opinion that said that, after interpreting 315A, and found that 315A does require a school board hearing prior to suspending a teacher for any length of time without pay.
Counsel, let's stop briefly at that opinion. And do you have it in front of you? Page 467 and 468 of the joint appendix. Got that?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay. I know you're looking at, I think, the first question, but go to the fourth question, bottom of page 467. It essentially says, can the local school system suspend as a disciplinary measure employees other than teachers? And it indicates that, at least as of 1983, a school board has the plenary power, quote, unquote, to discipline or suspend non-teachers. Do you agree with that?
I do.
In 1983, that was the case.
I do agree with you, okay. With that, Your Honor.
And so that plenary power exists outside of, or at least at the time, existed independently of the statute that we are looking at today. Do you agree with that?
I agree with that as it applies to non-teachers.
Exactly. Okay. Now, therefore, we would have to find that at some time after 1983, the General Assembly took an affirmative action that narrowed or constrained the pre-existing plenary power that was in existence in 1983. Is that correct?
I would agree with that. That's
okay. Go ahead with your narrative, please.
After the Attorney General's opinion in 1983, the Eastern District of Virginia in Wilkinson also considered the issue of whether 315A required school boards to conduct a hearing prior to suspending teachers without pay, and also concluded it did. In 3 years after that, Fairfax County School Board implemented a regulation that required the school board itself to conduct a hearing before suspending teachers without pay. And the authority cited by the school board in that regulation is Section 315A. And in fact, during the administrative hearing of this matter, the superintendent's designee stated that, yes, we follow the requirements of Wilkinson when it comes to teachers.
There was a lot of discussion about the Fairfax County procedures and regulations in the briefs and also at the summary judgment hearing. They don't control our decision is based, the assignments of error are based solely upon the statute, are they not?
That is correct, Your Honor. My point only is that at least as of 3 years after, at least as of 1986, when this regulation was implemented, that the school board itself manifested its interpretation of 315A, at least as it applies to teachers, to require a school board hearing prior to suspension.
But if you would, fast forward to where you allege the General Assembly specifically and clearly acted to constrain the pre-existing plenary power that the Attorney General had.
So in 1996, Your Honor, the General Assembly amended Section 315A and added all school employees. So instead of just teachers, which is what it read prior to 1996, the code was amended to say teachers and all other school employees are required to this process.
Go now, if you would, to the Joint Appendix pages 550 through 561, where the legislative drafting file is included in the record.
So, Your Honor, what were the figures?
Pages 550 through 561, the Joint Appendix.
Okay.
Did you object to that drafting file coming in?
We didn't object to it coming in during the motion for summary judgment oral argument.
Okay.
However, we would object to using and relying on it.
Okay, well, it's there. So what is your objection to us relying upon something that is in the joint appendix that both you and your opposing counsel have agreed upon?
Because I don't believe it's appropriate for the court in analyzing a statute that is what we would say is clear on its face, that has been interpreted over the years as requiring what we're saying it required, and the General Assembly never specifically overturned that, that it would be inappropriate and unnecessary to look to the legislative history.
Okay, that's a fair response. You indicate, your argument is that the second sentence of 315 is clear on its face in that the disciplinary procedures that are in that second sentence apply to non-teacher employees under any circumstance. Your opposing counsel says that the entire statute, the four corners of 315, when read as a whole, can only be interpreted to apply that second sentence in the context of the first sentence, which deals with crimes and other matters of public safety. Given that conflict, can we not look at the legislative drafting file to try to resolve that conflict?
Your Honor, you always could, but I would suggest it's unnecessary and unwarranted in this case for several reasons. First of all, the General Assembly affirmatively took another step that manifested its intention that school boards rely on Section 315A to suspend employees for any reason.
And what was that?
In 2009, the General Assembly amended Virginia Code Section 22.1-79.6, which is the grievance statute. Basically, the grievance process provides for orderly and expedited resolutions of disputes between employees and school system administrators. In 2009, the General Assembly amended the grievance statute to expressly remove from the grievance process suspensions. And not only did it remove it, it then excluded suspensions from the grievance process. So the only thing left in the Virginia Code is 315A with regard to the grounds and procedure for suspending employees. In fact, that's what the title says, grounds and procedure for suspending employees, which at least implies that this is all of the grounds and the only procedure that is to be used in connection with suspensions of school employees.
Are we permitted to use the title as we do our analysis?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe you are. We cite a Supreme Court case of the United States that says that every part of the statute it has meaning and that you can use it. And then I also cited a Virginia Supreme Court case that in which the court was analyzing the statute and referred to the statute's heading in order as part of that analysis. Okay.
My questions are satisfied. Thank you.
All right, so it really does take us all back to the step, why did 315A even get enacted to begin with? Because if everybody agrees, and I believe that both parties do agree, that school boards had this power to supervise, pursuant to their power to supervise employees, to suspend employees prior to 315A ever coming into existence. So the question is, why then in 1996, did the General Assembly, first of all, why did the General Assembly implement it to begin with? And second, why did it include all employees? The school board argues that this statute was amended along with two others, one of which required law enforcement officials to notify school officials if they arrest somebody who has committed a crime and so forth. And that this statute was then amended to add all employees so that it gave the, and according to the school board, that gave them authority, the school board authority, to suspend those employees for out-of-work conduct. But the school board already had that authority. And so what I would suggest that the better answer for that is that the General Assembly wanted to make sure that if you were going to suspend employees of the school board, you were going to do it in a cohesive manner, in a manner that is for all employees. We already had the teachers protected. The teachers had a right to a prior school board hearing prior to being suspended without pay. Now we're adding all employees that gave them that same protection, and I would think so, because the General Assembly wanted to have a uniform policy and practice with regard to that. And
let me ask this, though. If indeed you are correct that the second section of this statute applies to all discipline for all employees, does that trump a teacher's continuing contract when a teacher has tenure?
No, because again,
then how do you reconcile the two?
Because again, all this statute is saying is that you can suspend a teacher without pay, but you need to give them a school board hearing first, and you have to have just cause to do it, which is the same standard for terminating a teacher with continuing contract status. And going back to your previous question, because I'm not sure I answered it well enough, with regard to the distinction between the first and second sentences, I would suggest that, you know, why would this have been done to begin with? And did the General Assembly really mean to take away the school board's rights to suspend employees for just cause other than the two instances that are set forth in the first sentence? And I would suggest no. Second, if they did, then that first sentence would likely say school boards can suspend only under these two conditions. Or alternatively, what it could have said was, if the school board is suspending because an employee is a threat to the safety or welfare of the students or the school division or has been charged with a crime, then this. But it doesn't do that. It just says these are instances of just cause. The second sentence then accepts out one of the two mentioned grounds in the first sentence. I would suggest if the first sentence was going to, is all inclusive, you only can suspend under ground one and two, the second sentence would have said, and if you do it under two, then this. Why would you accept out one of only two things? I mean, it just doesn't.
Counsel, I'd like to ask you a question. You maintained in your reply brief that your client is not an at-will employee. Can you expand on that, please?
Yes. It would take going through the school board's related regulation, which I'm happy to do. But the school board in its own regulations state that discipline it should only occur for just cause, and I'm paraphrasing right now, and that suspension, dismissal, that dismissal is one of the most severe forms of discipline, and it should only be taken for just cause. So therefore, they're not at-will employees. Every employee of the school system, I believe, can't be terminated unless there is just cause pursuant to the school board's own regulation.
I have a completely different question. Did he answer you? Okay. In front of the trial court initially asked whether this case was appropriate for declaratory judgment, because I think all of the dates of the original suspensions had, the suspensions had occurred. They were over. And there was an oral amendment to the complaint that I could never find that was ever reduced to writing that was added new dates of suspension. Have those new dates now come and gone? Has your client, in fact, suffered those suspensions?
Your Honor, I'm not positive of the answer. I know that as of the date of the motion for summary judgment, my client was again notified she was being suspended for 3 additional days into the future. Now, whether they occurred, I'm really sorry.
They supposedly they were in 2013.
Then
so you have no reason to think that that was delayed or stayed until this case was over with.
But I would say that my client is in jeopardy, just as any other school employee is in jeopardy of being suspended at any time going forward without a school board hearing. That's been the school's practice.
I understand your position. I just wanted to note those that occurred. Thank you. Your time is up.
Thank you.
Morning. May it please the court. My name is Sona Wari, and I represent the athletes in Fairfax County School Board. I'd like to focus on exactly where the dispute is in this appeal. There's no dispute that before the 1996 amendment of Code Section 22.1-315, school boards had the power to suspend non-teacher employees for disciplinary reasons without pay and without a school board hearing. So the only question is, did the General Assembly in 1996 remove that power? And it's clear that that is not what the General Assembly was doing in 1996. Every provision of the 1996 Act of Amendment was directed toward a single common purpose, and that was to better equip school boards to protect students from potentially dangerous people.
What doctrine allows us to consider that legislative history, if the plain language is before us?
Your Honor, as the court said in Eberhardt versus Fairfax County Employee Retirement System, that is not legislative history. That's the plain language of the Act. The 1996 Act of Assembly is a legislative enactment. That is what the General Assembly passed. What we're looking at Section 22.1-315 is the codification that the Code Commission does. But to look at the full legislative enactment.
We can go to the Acts of Assembly. As you know, the General Assembly enacts an Act of Assembly that is signed by the governor, and that is actually the organic law of the Commonwealth. And the code is simply what a publisher does. But what about the what about the drafting file?
And you, I would say, one, you don't even need to go to the drafting file, because if you look at the legislative Act of Assembly, it's listed.
You're saying if you look at the Act of Assembly, all 3 statutes are included within the 4 corners of the Act of Assembly. Got
yes.
It. Okay.
And they're introduced in that act as an act to amend and reenact the 3 sections of the Code of Virginia relating to notification of arrest of school employees.
Okay.
That's how the act is explained. And so the legislative draft file, which, as Your Honor pointed out, was admitted without objection, and it just confirms what you find in the plain language of the Act of Assembly, that what the General Assembly was trying to do was it required law enforcement to alert school boards about the arrest of a broader array of employees for a broader array of offenses. And it provided that the purpose of that notice was so that school boards could remove these people from the schools. And it textually linked the alert statute to the suspension statute, which hadn't matched before. We'd said in our brief that only teachers were in the alert statute. In fact, teachers and employees were in the alert statute, but only teachers were in the suspension statute. So the language of those 2 statutes was made to match, and also the umbrella of employees that were covered by the alert statute was expanded because now it covered part-time, it covered temporary employees. So there were more employees, there were more offenses. And then it also required, the same act required school boards to collect more criminal background information from applicants and broaden the list of offenses that would disqualify people from being hired in the first place. So there was a single purpose to this act, and it was about protecting students and schools. It was not about giving non-teachers more rights. And to impute that intent to the General Assembly would be to assume that they were acting illogically, because it would make it easier to dismiss an employee, a non-teacher, than to suspend them, because there's no dispute that non-teachers have no right to a school board hearing before they can be terminated. They didn't have it in 1996, and they don't have it today. So the trial court was right to find that the 96th Amendment was about protecting students and schools, not about giving non-teachers more rights, and that statute doesn't apply to your ordinary run-of-the-mill disciplinary suspension. And the trial court's ruling benefits non-teachers because, as the court can see from the record, Ms. Payne's suspension was preceded by notice, an opportunity to be heard. It was followed by a five-step grievance procedure. There were a hearing before a hearing officer. There was a 200-page transcript with a detailed discussion of all the facts that led to this suspension.
And well, counsel, if that's just accepting that that she had the grievance procedure, just hypothetically, if she had been a teacher, could she have had a grievance procedure on the suspension if we interpret this statute as you want us to, just relating to these two issues?
We have not studied the statutes for suspension of teachers, but I believe that you can, that there is a grievance procedure for suspension of teachers. But as you know, under the Code of Virginia, teachers are vastly different from non-teachers.
I understand that, but my question is, if we interpret the statute the way the trial court did and the way you are suggesting here, a teacher who was suspended with or without pay, as counsel pointed out, the legislature passed an act in 1996 that said you can't grieve a suspension. A teacher cannot grieve a suspension. So what avenue of appeal recourse does a teacher have under your interpretation of the statute?
I think it's speculation to say that the 2009 change to the grievance procedure was tied to 22.1315. There's nothing in the indication that 13 years later those two things were tied. And as
ask you this question, because I understand you're trying what you want to do, but can a teacher take to the grievance procedure a suspension?
Yes. The school board allows suspensions to be grieved, and as the trial court pointed out, the school board is at liberty to give more rights, and a grievance is more rights. Allowing someone to grieve a suspension is more rights. When the General Assembly took it out in 2009, they were lessening the burden on school systems to say you don't have to allow grievances to be suspended. The argument that it was somehow taking away authority was not fully explained to the trial court, and the trial court itself, Judge Tran, pointed out, grievance is giving you more rights. It's not giving less rights. It doesn't help teachers or non-teachers for something to not be grievable. For it to be grievable is better for them. And so the fact that it was taken out of
the school board can pass a statute, can enact a regulation that contradicts the state statute. Is that what you're saying?
It's not in contradiction. It supplements. It gives more rights because the General Assembly never said that you would need both pieces. You would need it to say you can't grieve a suspension and the school board itself has to hear it. But the fact that in 1996 the statute that we're talking about was changed, and in 2009 there's something that pares back the level of review you have to provide for a disciplinary suspension, those two things are not connected. They were lessening the burden on school. And so were we to look at the 2009 legislative history, which is not in the record and not before the court, I think you would find that it was to provide less process, not more process.
Well, counsel, the teachers are not at-will employees.
Correct.
So we would need to look at their contracts under any circumstance. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
I want to focus in on that 2009 enactment. Your opposing counsel uses two pages of his brief, pages 30 and 31, to talk about that, and then responded today that that is significant in the context of understanding 315. It's significant by implication, is his argument today. And you don't deal with 22.179.6, the 2009 enactment, in your brief. And I wanted to give you the opportunity if you have anything. I think I understand his point, but it's only fair to say, what's your response to the point he made today?
I think you can read exactly that same provision, 79.6, to say you don't have to provide suspension and grievance, allow suspensions to be grieved, that it's actually lessening the burden. And it's pure speculation to say that this is a benefit. The argument that was made in the trial court as to how this could benefit is that they argued that a grievance procedure takes a long time. And so to take something out of suspension, take it out of the grievance procedure, benefits them somehow. But as the trial court pointed out, removing the list of things that can be grieved is not beneficial to the employee. Allowing more things to be grieved is beneficial to the employee. So the fact that the General Assembly does not require school boards to have a grievance procedure that allows an employee to challenge a suspension is strengthening the power of the school board. It is not helping the employee. So it is speculative say that in 2009, this change that happened in 2009 was somehow tied to 21-315. Those two are not linked in the sense that there's no reference in here to 22.1315. The only statute that's before the court that references 22.1315 is the criminal arrest notification statute, 19.2-83.1. It says that school boards shall be alerted, school division superintendents shall be alerted about the arrest of an employee, and that information can only be used to implement the suspension procedures in 22.115. Those two are connected. Those two work together amended. But what happened with 79.6 is not because there was a suspension procedure. And had they intended that, they would have provided it in the act. But plucking a statute that was amended years later and uses the same word, the two are not connected. And if the entire school board itself had to conduct a hearing regarding every disciplinary suspension, every employee that's habitually late, habitually insubordinate, school systems would be incentivized just to skip that step of progressive discipline altogether and go right to termination. So the trial court's reading of this statute benefits non-teachers because...
Could they go right to termination in light of 22.1315?
Yes, because 22.1315
doesn't
say anything.
There's no other statute that you're aware of that would prevent that?
Right. And so the idea that this statute was amended to include non-teachers as a benefit to them is not supported by the plain language of the Act, and it's not supported by the Act of Assembly, and it's not supported by logic, because if the General Assembly wanted to help non-teachers, then they would give them a right to a contract. They would give them a right to a hearing before a school board hearing before dismissal. They don't get a school board hearing before dismissal. So they would have been acting illogically and irrationally to address this tiny area and then leave open this huge area where you can dismiss them entirely.
Counsel, would you answer the question, or the counsel's response to my question, which he said that the non-teacher employee is not an employee at will because of the regulations established by the school board?
I think if you read the regulation by the school board, it almost word matches what this court addressed in County of Giles versus Wine, which is the regulation does not say an employee shall only be dismissed. The school board will only dismiss. Now, the division superintendent says the designee will recommend for just cause, and these are the things that could be just cause. But that's the language that the court focused on in County of Giles and said, there's a big difference between saying you will be recommended for dismissal for just cause and that you shall only be dismissed for just cause. So they are at-will employees. And again, we're talking about what does the General Assembly see them as? And so there's no question the General Assembly sees them as at-will because there's nothing in the code that says these employees won't be at-will. The General Assembly has done things very differently.
Counsel, one last question. In Wilkerson, the federal judge said that this section 315 established property rights for the teacher. If it's established the property rights for the teacher, now that it has been amended to include and other employees, why wouldn't that be true for other employees?
Well, the property right derived from the contract, but because the teachers are contract employees. And so the statute gave a right to, in Wilkinson's opinion, to have notice and opportunity and a hearing before they could be suspended because there was a property right in the contract. The non-teacher employees here don't have a property right, and 22.1315 wasn't amended to give them a property right because you need a contract that creates that expectation.
But Wilkerson said that the property right was established by 315 also, and he didn't have to decide, Judge Marriage didn't have to decide which one took precedence.
The procedures, my understanding is he read 22.1315 as creating a procedure for the right that existed at law. And so there isn't such a property right. And again, to read for 22.1315 is creating a property right for non-teachers where there's no contract right would be anomalous.
Thank you. Your time's expired. You used all your time. Call the next case, please.